It's Thursday in May, and this is International Edition from the Voice of America. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. An international group of diplomats tries to find a way to peace in Syria. Presidential politics in the United States, the Democrats remain split. The economy. Investors try to figure out which way to go as the Federal Reserve weighs a rate hike. And Garth Brooks playing in New York. It's all coming up on today's International Edition. The 17-nation International Syria Support Group, led by the United States and Russia, failed on Tuesday to reach any agreement that would clear the way for a resumption of suspended talks on Syria's political future in Geneva. A joint statement called for a full cessation of hostilities and immediate access of humanitarian aid to besieged areas. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, speaking after the meeting in Vienna, decried the uptick in violence that has undermined a two-month truce.
Russia has worked closely with the United States to upgrade our ability, which now has a 24-hour basis in Geneva with high-level people working consistently. But even then, it's difficult. And in the end, in order to make all of this more than words on a page, some very clear and determined actions are going to be needed in order to implement the steps that we just set out today.
The participants warn the warring factions in the five-year conflict, if they repeatedly break the truce, risk keeping the protection of the ceasefire. UN Syria envoy Staffan de Mistura also discussed a June 1st deadline to gain access to all besieged areas in Syria.
We are still not reaching those we want to reach. Out of 18 besieged locations, and by the way, besieged areas is the closest to a medieval type of siege that we've seen in recent history. Only, and perhaps not only, but 12 of them have been reached. So the concept and the idea have been approved that if we cannot reach them by land, as we have been doing together with the World Food Program in Deir ez-Zor successfully, having a joint operation between Russian Federation, U.S., and other countries in dropping aid to 110,000 people, we need to start working hard in order to be able to look at the option within security limits, but that's what we all have to work on, to actually do the same everywhere else where we cannot get by land unless we are allowed to go by land.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov insisted on Tuesday that Moscow is not fighting on behalf of any side of the conflict. Regional analyst Stefan Zunes of the University of San Francisco tells VOA's Victor Beatty that there is little that came out of the meeting in Vienna that engenders optimism.
The humanitarian situation on the ground is still quite desperate. The Syrian government has not come through with their promises to allow for humanitarian relief to get through. This, of course, has frustrated the opposition to the point that they're hoping that refusing to return to the talks will thereby increase international pressure on the Syrians. But unfortunately, it sounds like all sides really are still following the false premise that they could advance their cause by continuing to refuse to make political progress.
There don't seem to be much in the way of penalties or consequences for actions taken. Secretary of State John Kerry did indicate that beginning June 1st, if UN road convoys are denied access to besieged areas, the International Syria Support Group would mandate the World Food Program immediately carry out air bridges and airdrops. And he did mention the Syrian military. Will there be any pressure put on Syria?
This would put the Syrians into something of a dilemma. Clearly, the prospect of shooting down humanitarian aid relief like that would be politically untenable, even for Damascus. And it would also show that the international community was determined to at least get some kind of relief to those who most need it.
Russia's foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, indicated that Russia has not very much influence on the Syrian government and its activities on the battlefield. Is that true or not, in your view?
Though Russian airstrikes made an important difference during the phase of the Civil War and in which they were active, overall, the idea that the Russians can influence the political direction that the Damascus regime will or will not go, they really don't have that kind of power.
And Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said that Russia does not support President Bashar al-Assad. He says Moscow supports the fight against terrorism. We turn now to see what's trending online. And to do that, we have our social media correspondent, G. Abby Lee, here in Studio 22. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim.
So, it's about U.S. presidential race again.
It is, but this segment will have some international flair to it. The first trending story involves Donald Trump's wife, Slovenia-born Melania Trump. Her recent remarks on a reporter with Politico magazine is heavily criticized by Israel's oldest daily, Haaretz. The reporter said she received death threats and anti-Semitic slurs after she published a profile of Melania Trump. Now, to that claim, Melania Trump said Julia Ioffe is the one that provoked such reactions from her quote-unquote fans.
Well, how is the online community responding to all this?
To the Haaretz Facebook post, people are commenting the couple is not condemning the abuse because they thrive on such support from these people. But that doesn't mean he's not popular abroad. Not at all, really.
Well, I do hear that Trump has some popularity in China, particularly, and also Africa among certain demographics. What gives with this?
Well, it all began with a list of 11 candidates that Donald Trump would nominate to work as Supreme Court Justice and if and when he gets elected. Now, the seat was previously held by the late Justice Antonin Scalia. And when he announced the list on Facebook, he received more than 1,700 comments. And one of the most liked replies from the UK. It reads like this. I am English, not American, just to clear that up. Many of you may have heard about how people are wanting to ban him from entering the UK and how he is some sort of fascist. Let me tell you, not everyone in the UK thinks the same way, even if our Prime Minister and our quote-unquote terrible Muslim mayor of London disagrees with you. It went on for longer, but you can definitely tell this person is a Trump supporter. Another reply was by an Indian. The user wrote, I'm an Indian. And I still love you. Well, that's a big word. Because the world needs leaders like you. We had Modi, who acted and spoke like you, but he went down the road of political correctness. Yikes, political correctness. What a terrible thing to do. Mm. He's referring to sitting Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi. I don't know if I would describe him the same way, but people seem to like Trump for what they perceive as not having a filter and speaking up for what he believes. Jim?
Well, thank you for speaking up on what's happening online. G. Abby Lee joins us each and every day on International Edition. And if you like, you may tweet your questions and comments to our stream at VOA_IE. Tag myself and G while you're doing that on our tweets. We're at VOA Stevenson and at G. Abby Lee. Here are some of the top stories that are trending right now in Asia. Afghanistan disappointed in four-way talks about Taliban. Rescue teams search landslide-hit areas for survivor in Sri Lanka. U.S. sanctions on Myanmar will not hurt, says Aung San Suu Kyi. Donald Trump opened to talks with North Korea's Kim Jong-un. Hong Kong NGOs fear that new rules will jeopardize work on mainland. You can follow these stories with expanded coverage and much more on our website at voanews.com and also on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. U.S. presidential candidates are still seeking votes and convention delegates on the road to the White House. VOA senior national correspondent Jim Malone joins us in the studio as Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders remain in a heated battle. And Jim, the Democrats are growing in numbers to try to convince Sanders to stop.
They wouldn't be going after him as much if Clinton was finding a way to sort of put him away, but she's not. She barely won the Kentucky primary. She lost Oregon. The narrative, though, has taken a little bit of a darker turn now. The longer this has gone on, the tensions between the campaigns have grown. And this is exactly the wrong time for this to happen. Democrats are now worried that as the party seeks to unify, to heal the wounds, to bring Sanders into the Clinton camp to face Donald Trump, presumably, that, you know, the tensions are undermining what they're trying to do. And this was on display most recently at an event last Saturday in Las Vegas, a Nevada state Democratic convention where they choose delegates to go to the convention in Philadelphia in July. Kind of broke into a mess with Sanders supporters upset with the Democratic Party leadership, started throwing chairs. There were even threats made against the state party chairwoman. This is the kind of thing Democrats want to stop before it kind of devolves out of control. And it shows you the challenge ahead for both Clinton and Sanders. It's going to take some doing to patch this party up, assuming Clinton remains on track to be the nominee.
Meanwhile, Donald Trump is working the room, if you will. He's been meeting with top Republican leaders and trying to maybe present a more presidential air to his campaign, meeting with Henry Kissinger today.
Yeah, and definitely on foreign policy, I think a lot of Republicans would be endorsing this move, not necessarily that they think everything Kissinger has to say is something that should be followed, but in the wake of some of the Trump comments, most notably that he would sort of unilaterally meet with the leader of North Korea, which would sort of undo, you know, years, decades of U.S. foreign policy approaches from both parties, I think Republicans are looking for signs that Trump is going to be listening to the adults in the room and kind of reining in some of his more cavalier and unprompted comments and responses. This is all part of Trump's effort to bring the Republican Party together. And I've also noticed, even in the most recent interview with Megyn Kelly on Fox, he seemed to project a softer tone, not quite as cantankerous, even though in the same interview he said he knows what got him through the primaries, he knows what got him to win, which is his, you know, boisterous nature and saying it like it is, and he has no plans to backtrack. So the challenge for some of the Republicans looking at Trump going forward is which Donald Trump will appear on any given day.
Yeah, and beyond the Republicans, I mean, he has quite a sales job to the voters at large to reposition himself, to repackage himself, maybe even rebrand himself in a sense, where he can say, yes, I am this, you know, very forward guy who's going to get things done, but I'm not going to tick off everybody along the way necessarily.
Yeah, it's really about remaking his image to a degree. And that's a challenge for any politician because the Democrats are already out there with ads trying to remind people of what Trump has said, literally using his own words, especially when castigating women or Muslims, various ethnic groups, the immigration issue. So they're not going to forget that. You also wonder, the Trump approach apparently is going to be he's going to try to soften, you know, some people's attitudes about him and get them to forget about some of the comments he's made. But in politics, that can backfire because if you're going to go back about things you said, you're almost reminding people about what you said.
All things that we're going to be keeping track of as we continue on the road to the White House. Jim Malone, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and insights with us.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
U.S. financial markets were essentially flat Wednesday amid choppy trading over the past few weeks. And as a result, investors are having a difficult time figuring out just where to make their moves. VOA financial correspondent Jill Malandrino joins us from New York as one of the issues they're weighing is a possible interest rate hike by the U.S. Federal Reserve.
Well, for the first time in a long time, they've been pretty clear with the minutes that were released this afternoon that a June interest rate hike is on the table. They discussed raising hikes in April, but they were decided against it ultimately. So this left the window open for a June hike. Second quarter data, they believe, will continue to improve. And they're seeing strong data come in, although there is choppiness in the market because the last data that I looked at, GDP was not good at all. Retail sales were good, but in pockets. The employment headline number, it's good, but when you dig down deeper, it's kind of not that good. Earnings have been okay. We've seen some beats in certain areas of the market, but on lower estimates. So a lot of the data is mixed. And traders are scratching their heads, did we wait too long for a rate hike? Fact of the matter is, it needs to be done at some point in 2016. I'm of the camp, if they do a rate hike in June, the market sort of get what it wants. You'll see volatility following the rate hike announcement. It happens all the time. For longer-term investors, kind of let the traders play their game, keep your powder dry, and kind of let the situation play out. I think for them to wait until after the election, it's not going to be what the market wants should data continue to decline. So if they get it done in June, we don't have to worry about it in November, and then they could do another one in December like we had last year, or wait until 2017. So I think if they're going to do it at any point, June is the time that they should be doing it.
So a few things looking good, but always the devil in the details. And what's bubbling underneath for a lot of investors is what's going on in Europe and the possible Brexit situation.
Right. So I think the two biggest issues that we're going to have to deal with through the summer outside of the election is the rate hike, which the markets will get themselves through. And again, the Fed, its first priority is not to establish policy based on how the market might react. That's not their first priority. They need to look at bigger macro pictures, such as what's happening with the dollar. We don't want it to go too high on this news. They also want to see how other foreign currencies reacting with it. So between, you know, keeping the dollar in check, keeping the global currency stable, the Brexit situation really does matter. Exiting the European Union is going to create quite a shift on the continent. And, I think those are going to be the two volatility events that we have to get through. The next meeting will be at some point, usually it's around the third week in June, and then the Brexit is set for June 23rd for the vote. So, you know, in the absence of earnings, and this happens a lot when we're in an earnings vacuum, the entire market shifts its focus to macro issues, and that's where we start to see some of that volatility. So it'll be interesting to watch for sure. But again, as long-term retail investors, just let the situation play out and allow the markets kind of return to the way they normally function.
Well, it's all about managing change, but one thing never changes. We always get some great information from Jill Malandrino in New York. Jill, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA. I'm Victor Beatty. Since 1942, the Voice of America has been a consistently reliable and authoritative source of news. Today, VOA remains committed to providing an accurate, objective, and comprehensive news product at the top of every hour, every day. We can be heard on your local affiliate or streamed on the web at voanews.com.
VOA Special English. A way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. It's been nearly 20 years since country music superstar Garth Brooks played for an audience in New York City. But as International Edition's David Byrd reports, the multiple Grammy Award winner is now set to play at Yankee Stadium in July.
Blaming all of my roots, I showed up in bells and ruined your black tie beer.
The last time Garth Brooks played New York City, 750,000 people showed up for his 1997 Central Park show. Brooks, who has also won multiple Entertainer of the Year awards from the Country Music Association, returns to the Big Apple with a concert at Yankee Stadium July 9th. At a news conference for the show, Garth said that he jumped at the chance to play in New York again, especially at Yankee Stadium.
It wasn't my thought. It wasn't my brainchild. The Yankees actually came to us and said, man, would you ever think about playing Yankee Stadium? It's like, I guess not, but I guess I dream of it, you know? And so I said, are you really serious? This is possible. They said, yeah. I said, well, what a way to return to New York after Central Park. So this makes sense. If you're going to do anything big, you do it in this city. If you're going to do something big in this city, Central Park, Yankee Stadium, I think that's the way to do it.
Brooks, who released his latest album of original songs in 2014, after a 13-year hiatus, said he wanted to perform for his devoted fans. The 54-year-old singer and guitarist said he gets emotional when he thinks about what music has meant to him.
Well, they talk about your musical heroes or what music means to you. Man, you don't talk about what music means to me, it's going to get really sappy really quick, because that's my breath in and my breath out.
Garth Brooks' tour has recently sold its 4 millionth ticket, but he says he still enjoys watching and learning from other performers.
Well, I mean, you got guys like Jason Aldean, who's a true entertainer, which I like. And I know it's not country we're talking about. We just saw Justin Timberlake, another true entertainer. I was lucky enough to get to see Beyonce's Vegas show that she built solely for Vegas. I got to see it in person. Entertainer. I mean, take out your notebook and take notes. No matter how long you've been on the stage, take notes on that one. And just guys like that. I love them.
Tickets for the Yankee Stadium show go on sale May 20th. Brooks and his wife, Trisha Yearwood, will perform, but there's no definite word on whether New York's own Billy Joel, who joined Brooks in his 1997 show, will also be there. I'm David Byrd, VOA News.
Good to hear fans in New York are going to get to hear Garth Brooks and see him on stage. You've been hearing and listening to International Edition. You can always find us at our website, voanews.com. We're also out there on Facebook. VOA Now is the place to go. And Twitter, at @VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter. Engineer Carl Starling. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're all in Washington, and we thank you so much for spending part of your day with us. Come back again when you can. Have a great day ahead.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Out of the rubble of the Second World War, a determined generation on both sides of the Atlantic built an international system of institutions and norms dedicated to peace, progress, and democratic governance. In an address in Warsaw, Poland, U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Antony Blinken noted that this great transatlantic project, first formed to prevent a return to war between great powers and to create a stable environment where countries could develop to the benefit of all their citizens, expanded later to support the peaceful transition to democracy of the newly free nations of Central Europe. This legacy, he said, provided a foundation of democracy and stability that has underwritten an unparalleled period of peace and prosperity for Europe, the United States, and much of the world. Now, Deputy Secretary Blinken said, there are challenges confronting Europe and the transatlantic community from a variety of directions. They include the threat of violent extremism and a campaign of terror that has scarred communities from Paris to Lahore, from Ankara to Brussels. The epicenter of this campaign, he observed, thrives in the shadows of the Syrian civil war, which has sent hundreds of thousands of Syrians fleeing into Europe. Another challenge has emerged in the form of Russian aggression, said Deputy Secretary Blinken, which has violated the sovereignty and territorial integrity of an independent, democratic nation and imperiled the vision of a Europe whole, free, and at peace. Russia's occupation and attempted annexation of Crimea and aggression in eastern Ukraine threatened to undermine basic international principles, among them that borders cannot be changed by force, that it is the right of citizens in a democracy to determine their country's future, that all members of the international community are bound by common rules and should face costs if they violate their solemn commitments. Our unity is essential in deterring our adversaries who try to exploit our disagreements, said Deputy Secretary Blinken. But like the dictators of the mid-20th century, they misjudge open debates as division, and they misunderstand the singular and universal lesson of history, that democracy, liberty, and the rule of law are not sources of vulnerability and insecurity, but constitute our greatest reservoir of strength and stability. United in purpose and principle, our alliance has stood the test of time and the trials of crisis, and it has always emerged stronger, said Deputy Secretary Blinken. I am confident the same will long continue as we rise to meet our generation's challenges.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.